now at
Mr. Elliot
Mr.
Boom.
Elliott's house in
Chesn.
Chesn, Rags Lane, Grange,
Burton Grange.
Burton Grange, and he's just shown me that he's drawn a map of the North Site Millwright shop, the building on the corner by the roundabout, and he's going to explain some of the features to me. So we're now facing you're look with you're face looking north, aren't you, with the long walk going away to this top left-hand corner of the plan. So yes, right, okay then, Bob. Let's see what we've got. You said it was done by a beam engine.
The shafting in that particular shop was worked by a beam engine, but not in my time,
No.
not in 36. It was taken away just after the First World War.
Oh, that was yes. That was before 36. You had the beam engine before you
So
reached
the
that point.
shafting was had been worked by electric motor for many, many
Oh yeah.
years, and we had here the office with
Yes.
the principal foreman,
That
Mr. Joe Threadgold.
would be in the southwest corner, wouldn't it?
That's
Southwest
in the
corner.
corner, yeah.
Yeah.
And the stores was on the left-hand
On the
side,
west side
yeah.
there.
And there's many names that people in the Abbey would most probably still
Oh
recognise.
yes. Yeah.
George Thorogood, a bell ringer of Waltham
Oh
Abbey,
yeah.
is the heavy gang chief. He was chief of the heavy gang.
This is these are the members of the
They
heavy
are the
gang,
heavy
yes.
gang and pipe
Mansfield,
fitters
Baines,
and four
White.
inch pipe fitters. They were heavy pipe
Heavy.
fitters,
Oh yes.
known as heavy pipe fitters.
Yeah.
This list of names here are all the fitters and turners.
Yes, it's running along the side here, yeah.
So we have a list
Well,
there.
starting with Englefield and Sale and Dumblebee, yeah.
This you've got a Bill Wilson here that became foreman. Of course, you had a Stan King. He
Oh
became
yes.
foreman.
Ozzy Edwards, is that the one it'd be Ozzy Edwards who worked with me on the south side?
South Site foreman Bill
Yeah.
Wilson, yeah.
Oh yeah. No, Ozzy Edwards.
And Ozzy Edwards was there as a fitter,
Oh yeah.
35,
Yeah.
yeah. And
Bill
Charlie,
Elliott Popeye. Oh yeah.
yeah,
Bill Elliott
that's
Popeye.
my namesake, Popeye Elliott,
Oh yes, not yes.
notorious union man
Yes.
who was transferred to the lock and who finished up shop steward convener. He had his own office down the lock, pinstripe trousers, the whole outfit,
Sure.
and he ruled the lock with a
Yeah, that's the rule.
With a rod of iron
Yeah.
as
That'd
regards.
be in the 30s, late 30s.
That was from 1937 when he got transferred, or 38, might have been 38. He got transferred to the lock and he was there right through the war,
Oh yes.
right through to the end of the war. And he was the chief,
And that was his name was
that was Bill Elliott.
Bill Elliott. Oh yes.
Been my name.
Yeah.
They called him Popeye.
Yes.
Call
Oh
him
yeah. Because,
Popeye. Why'd they call him
well, because he
Popeye?
had rather bulging eyes, I think.
Popeye, you can imagine that.
And he
The
was
other
a,
voice is Joyce, Bob's wife. Yeah.
and he was a character. He
Yeah,
was
yeah.
one of
Oh
the
yes.
characters in that shop.
Would you like a cup of coffee or something?
Oh, I don't. Just a
Coffee
little
or
one, yeah.
tea? Coffee.
Oh, tea if you're making
Tea?
it, yeah.
No, I've just made him a cup of coffee.
All right, that'd be fine,
Get sugar
yes.
Well,
with
never
it.
mind
No
beer
thanks,
first.
no.
I'd like a drop of beer first. Well, we could go out on a Tuesday morning.
Oh, sorry. Oh,
Two
well, sorry,
friends down the
I'm
corner.
butting in a bit.
I mean, I'll
But
cancel it for
anyway, it's
tomorrow.
very kind of you to get this down. Yeah. And in the office we had
And
Joe.
that was Joe Threadgold. He was transferred to Bishopton a year later.
Was he related to Freddie Threadgold on the building works?
He
Do you
was a
know that?
relation to Freddie Threadgold, who was chief of Borough House, number 5 Borough House.
Oh yes.
And old Mr.
Yeah.
Threadgold, he was quite older. He was in his 60s, so he did retire just when war broke out.
Oh, so I knew a Threadgold. I thought he was
Yes, there
in.
was a Threadgold
I thought he was built.
carpenter's.
Oh, carpenters,
Yeah, that's
that's
right.
right.
That was
Yeah.
his uncle.
Oh yes. Oh
That
yeah.
Fred, Joe Threadgold was the carpenter's foreman's uncle.
Yeah. Oh
Yeah.
yeah.
Anyway, George Goodiron, he was a scoutmaster, a local scoutmaster in the Chesnut Waltham Cross. Arthur Wilson,
Was that Tug?
Tug Wilson, yeah. He came from the Small Arms. He started here on the same day as what I did. There was two apprentices and Arthur, who transferred as a man, of course, to become charge hand over boilers from the Small Arms factory. I knew his two sons, Arthur's sons, so he knew me very well.
What's this then? Then you've got a Blanchard here.
That was Blanchard, yeah.
He was
a relation of the Blanchard of the mainland.
That's right, Walter Blanchard.
Yeah, he was a cousin of him.
And what was...
His name was Jimmy Blanchard,
Jimmy,
I think.
Oh, yes.
He was a cousin of the one who used to wear the gaiters, the leather gaiters.
Oh, in the main lab?
That was the main lab, He used to wear grocers, what I call grocers' gaiters. When the weather was a bit damp.
Yes.
A character he was.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a Blanchard. Now we have here the Cordite dies, where I finished up working on Cordite dies. That was Bill Knight.
You actually worked in this corner.
I worked on Cordite
dies.
And right up to 1940.
That's in the south.
That's
corner.
In the corner. That's in the corner of this big old building. Oh, yeah. And that was Bill Knight and Cecil Avery. He was transferred to Bishopton.
Oh, yeah.
And I took his place on Cordite dies.
Oh, yeah.
Very...
It
was the highest class work done in that machine, the whole of the factory.
Yeah.
It was a most precision job that was done in the whole factory.
Because those bores, and I don't understand.
Yeah, they
those
were ultra precisioners.
Yeah,
they wasn't ground finishes or nothing like that, but they was very, very nicely reamed finishes. All those bores. Those dies.
Did they used to have a lead in or something? Were they?
Yes, they had lead ins. Yeah. They had lead ins for the cordite.
Oh, yeah.
Now, as far as I know, or may I ask a question here, is there any of these dies been retained?
There are quite a number of dies. Yeah. But
you sure no sugar?
No, thanks, Joyce. Right, no, that's lovely. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well. There was many new dies made in 1938 when they could see war was coming.
Yeah.
And yet it was never spoken about. You never hear anybody speak of any coming war.
It
was just that everybody got more busier and busier. And yet there was never a mention of war breaking out, which is when I look back on it, that's a very strange thing.
Isn't it? Yes.
Yes. Anyway.
Don't think about it, and it won't happen.
We started to remake the tape dies for the ACAC shells that hadn't been made since the First World War, the dies, and had lost all the replicate of the dies that were in existence after the First World War were all lost and destroyed and scrapped.
Yeah.
We had to start from scratch. We had the drawings, and in 1938, when I went on to dies, we had to start making the new tape dies right from scratch. There was nothing to copy from. It was all from drawings.
Tape
dies. That was tape cordite.
Oh, what? It came out of the middle?
Yeah, that was about half inch wide by 16th to an eighth thick. And that was tape, what they call tape dies.
You had four of those?
Yeah, and that had a lead in. The lead in on the big gunmetal, they were gunmetal dies.
Yeah.
See, cordite. The big cordite, large cordite, preferred gunmetal.
Mm-hmm.
Not bronze, brass. It had to be gunmetal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It wouldn't run properly with any other metal.
No.
Only gunmetal. And it had to have a nice, smooth run in, otherwise it wouldn't it wouldn't project properly. It would wrinkle, what they call wrinkle.
Oh, yes, gather up as it came out of the...
Come out wrinkly.
Yeah. Oh, yes, sorry about that, I just...
You want again?
Yes, it's going now.
With over the large cordite dies.
Mm. How would you would you cut those slots? Would it be like planed out, or I don't know the word? You know, you couldn't drill out a slot. Would you drill out a line of holes and then file them into shape?
Yes, but the cordite, mainly cordite, the ordinary cordite was in tube form.
Oh, yes. I was thinking how you actually made these slots in the metal.
Well, it was in tube form. So the bore, a cordite bore hole, had to have a centre pin for the cord. I had to wrap round the centre pin, and it would come out in tube form. The rifle cordite, which was 052 diameter, had a hypodermic needle suspended in the centre.
Yeah.
And that had to be, that hypodermic needle was supplied by an air flow hole.
Oh, yes.
In order to stop the cordite collapsing.
Oh, of course, otherwise it would collapse when it came off the end of the...
Instead of being a tube or a little hole through the cordite, this is rifle cordite, 303, it would collapse if the hole got black hot.
Yes, I'd never thought of that, of course. I just thought you had a core, but of course, if you didn't have let air in, it would just fold in on it.
Well, if the establishment has got any... dyes.
Well, we'll definitely look into it, and I think I ought to sort of bring them along.
If any dyes have been salvaged from the colossal plundering of the factory.
Oh, yes.
This was what happened.
Yeah.
I say this? I only regret I never acquired a few which they did allow certain commodities at the time to be retained by employees. What they call permanent loan.
Yeah.
And they certainly never included cordite dyes.
No.
Because the war was on, and they would never let anything like that be released to the public.
It's a pity, because I'm sure a lot of the artifacts are going to, if they eventually are collected, are going to be found in people's lofts, because they've destroyed so much of it.
Yes. I mean, I could have had one of each of all different types of cordite dyes. That was the dye I'm talking about is the one that was fitted to the small presses, what they call small screw presses. It was made in number 10 press house. Number 10 press house was the largest press house that pressed all rifle cordite and revolver cordite, known as Lady's Hair.
Yes.
That was number 10 press house. The story is that it was built for the Russian government, or the Russians paid for number 10 press house for the First World War, for rifle cordite.
That's funny, because Dennis Mansell, who I've just been talking to this morning, he worked in 10 press house.
Number 10 press
house. And he was saying that when he was there, early part, when he first came back in 49, they were still making this lady's hair and reeling it.
Yeah, that's right. That was revolver 38 and 45.
Oh, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Well, we made the dyes for ladies' hair.
016, was it?
The bore, I couldn't remember.
Oh, no, sorry, I'm thinking of something else. It was solid.
Solid dyes, they were.
Yes.
There was no centre pin, therefore it...
Was revolver, it about 16,000?
Revolver cordite was solid. There was no, it wasn't tubular.
No, that was the hair. Sorry.
That was one of the hairs. It was so fine, it was impossible to get a bore hole through it.
Mm.
It was the 052 bore rifle cordite size. That was very difficult to maintain, but it was possible, and it worked.
Oh, you could maintain a hole through the centre, yes.
Yes, and we also made a lot of dyes that was used in the small presses in number 10. It was light ACAC ammunition that had multiple holes. Core holes, as many as six. So when you looked at a section of the cordite, it would be about a quarter of an inch diameter. There's six little holes right the way through.
Oh, yes.
And these were made by Bill Knight and myself, solely. Yes. This was an experiment, as far as I can remember. One particular scientist down there, what a scientist, official of cordite, he could have been, he wasn't that man, I don't think, although he was superintendent at the time.
Oh, yeah.
They wanted these to see if it was possible to put six little holes through the cordite. And they were not fed by air. These pins were solid pins standing vertically in the bore.
Yes.
So, and when the cordite was made, You did have the holes did used to collapse a little bit, but it.
Well, of course, it was a larger bore cord. I said it had more strength than itself.
It was for quick.
What was the diameter of it?
The hole was only in the cord art for rapid burning.
Oh yes, because it would burn down.
That's all it was for.
What was the overall diameter of this multi-core stuff?
Might be 2/10 up to about 1/4.
Oh, yeah, it was quite big.
It was like stuff.
Why, it would hold the bores, wouldn't it? Because it wouldn't collapse so easily.
And the pins did used to bend.
Yeah.
But anyway, they did let that cordite go through.
Were they free floating or?
Yes, they were anchored. They were anchored to a little tiny plate.
Yeah.
That was. In the flow of the cordite, there was holes that allowed the cordite to come through the supply holes in the plate, wrap themselves round the core, these pins, and reach the final ejection bore, and then it came out into the open, where it would rapidly dry, and of course it was reeled. But I'm not positive about whether the big stuff was reeled. They might not have been. They might have cut that to length as it came out.
Yeah.
But they were made on the small presses. Mm-hmm. The large presses only pressed out the large cordite up to about 3/8 diameter.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
That'd be for quite big guns, I suppose.
Yes, and it was coloured. Yeah. The different types of cordite dye was added to identify it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And that was quite. And I, of course, I became Bill Knight's second in command on cordite dyes. And then when war broke out, 1939, Stan King, who was a very good turner, he was put with us. That made three of us. Young man, of course. I was still the apprentice.
Yeah,
and I took over that entire cordite dyes. Bill Knight used to always have his Sunday off.
Yeah.
And I used to work every Sunday in his place because those dyes were maintained 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Owing to war broken out, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
They'd come back for repair to you and things like that, wouldn't they?
And I was on cordite dyes right till I was called up in 1941.
Yes.
And Stan King was still on the job.
Oh, you were called up in 1941?
I was called up in 1941 eventually. Yeah, yeah. The factory started to ease up a bit.
Oh, yeah.
Not 1941, but 1943.
Yeah, 1943.
And I was called up because we was all registered as millwrights.
Yeah.
And that was a mistake. We should have been registered as turners who had a longer period of exemption.
Yeah. Oh,
yes. Like the small arms.
It was political, wasn't it? I mean, the politicians didn't know the difference between them. I assumed a millwright was of a lower grade than a turner.
You see, this machine shop was under the management of the small arms factory.
Mm-hmm.
The chief manager, whoever, I can't think of his name.
From
he was the boss of this millwright shop as well.
Oh,
and he came to the powder mills once a week on a Friday morning, I think it used to be, and have a quick look round and spend some hours in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his duty.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Griffiths was the general manager. Griffiths was the under manager. But solely in charge of the engineering of the gunpowder factory.
Oh, yeah.
That was a Mr. Griffiths.
Mm-hmm.
With him, of course, there was auxiliary type management, which concentrated on the acid factories, mainly north side acid factory, where the pickleite was made, a nitroglycerine factory.
Did you ever have occasion to go up to the acid factory?
Yes, I had done quite a few months up there, acid factory.
That was a bit of a... I only ever saw it from the outside.
No. Well, up there, they had a giant refrigeration plant.
Yes.
They I'm not sure if it was one or two. Two big single cylinder fridge engines, steam engines.
Oh, yeah.
By the firm Dartmouth firm, what's their name now? Refrigeration people.
Huh.
Anyway, these two big engines used to supply the coolant, which was coolant brine to the nitroglycerine mixing house, which was known as the Hill.
Oh, yes. The brine was pumped across.
Pumped pipes. And you'd see all the frost on the outside of the pipes. Mm. Yeah. And that used to go into the... And when the explosions happened in 1940, they feared that the refrigeration pipes had all been fractured and that. And there was a possibility of the nitroglycerine mixing house going and exploding. But it didn't. Oh, fortunately, the pipe work didn't get that damaged. And there was no risk there. They thought there might be.
Well, they thought that might have caused the trouble, or...
The cooling breaking down, causing the nitroglycerine to overheat.
Oh, yes.
In the mixing house, which was surrounded by enormous abutments, what you might call it.
Yeah.
And because that made it look like a small hill, and it was known.
Was it mixing the paste for the gun cotton and the nitroglycerine mixed together? Was that...
I'm referring now to the manufacture of pure nitroglycerine.
Oh, pure nitroglycerine, yes.
In this nitroglycerine blending house, mixing house, which you could call it.
Yeah.
And then from there, of course, the nitroglycerine was a product which was later used in other buildings in order to make the cordite or to make the dough. It was that part of the explosive side of it, I'm not too familiar. But
what were conditions like in the acid factory? It was pretty horrific, wasn't it? The conditions in the acid factory, the fumes and the...
The conditions were pretty grim. Yes, and sir. It was all lit up at night time before the war, and then the blackout. It was all lit up at night, and it looked like a small oil refinery.
Yes.
With all the smoke and steam.
I never saw it walking along the path, but I never got into it.
No, well, there was two boiler houses up there. Number three, which had four boilers. And men, I've seen men stripped to the waist, stoking them boilers in number three in the summertime. Yeah. Solid, large coal, burnt large coal, Lancashire boilers. Number one boiler house was bigger, but they only ever used... about four boilers in there. I believe there were six boilers in number one, but they only had two or three, maybe four. Number three boilers were used for the engines, higher pressure. Yeah. Number one boiler house supplied wet steam for the vats and general steam purposes.
Oh, yes. But would this be just for the acid factory?
This is just for the acid factory. Yes. Nitroglycerine factory. The nitroglycerine enclosure was all supplied by steam. Yeah. Steam engines driving the fans in the stoves in that area.
Oh, yeah. They were driven
by single cylinder steam engines.
Oh, yeah.
Way out in the woods, you'd see a shed with you'd see the steam puffing out of this.
Oh, that's why I've been walking around looking at the map. I've seen little sheds that have been called engine houses.
Engine houses, they were single cylinder steam engines in there.
Driving, they'd be driven off the main
steam main. They had 6-foot flywheels, and they used to drive...
6-foot flywheels?
About 6-foot diameter in there. And they used to drive quite a large fan.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was cool air going through the heaters. The steam also... supplied the heat for the steam heaters, for the tubular heaters, copper.
Oh, yeah.
And the hot air was put through the inside of the tubes, I think.
Would that be for
and
the stoves?
Steam was on the, they were condenser type heaters in reverse.
Mm.
But they were heating tube heaters. Supplied by steam, and the hot air was pushed through these heaters, and the air flow going into the stoves, of course.
Oh, that was for heating the stoves.
It was heated in that way. By steam heating.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, I've been wondering how the stoves...
Those stoves were very isolated.
Yeah.
As they would have to be. In case one blew, it wouldn't affect the other.
Oh, yeah.
But they proved wrong when the 1940 explosion occurred. One stove did set off another.
Oh, yes.
And that's why there was...
In spite of the travelers.
That's why there was five explosions. And I was there. I wasn't in the engine enclosure.
Yeah.
I was present in the machine shop.
But when they went off?
When the roof left the brickwork five times. What, we saw the roof.
In the
machine shop where
this one here, the
flat section of the roof, half the building was slated.
Mm.
And the other half, when I say slated, it was
pitched roof.
Mm. The other half was flat with zinc top.
Oh, yeah.
That portion lifted off the brickwork. We all stood there and watched it with all the dust coming down, an enormous cast iron girder right the way through, or two thirds of the way through the machine shop, broke in half and hung down at an angle of about 100 degrees like this.
Yeah.
Broke clean in the centre. I suppose it was about 6 foot from a man's head that might be standing there. In other words, it finished up about 12 foot from the ground. We actually see that.
Cool.
And I was talking to, at the moment of the first explosion, which was the one we felt the most. The second explosion, we didn't feel much.
It happened soon after, did it?
That was soon after.
Yes.
The first one was the one that really done the damage.
Mm.
And of course, we knew somebody must have got killed. We wasn't allowed to move outside the shop. At that moment, when it happened, we all tried to take shelter inside them.
Well, yes, it's like you didn't know what was going to happen next.
We all tried to get underneath the benches, but we couldn't. Because there was...
Or the foreman under there.
The foreman beat the steward.
How long was it between the first big bang and the other ones?
Well, I suppose I would say the pause from the first one was the longest. Mm. Might have been about 4 seconds.
Oh, as close as that.
Yeah, yes. 4 or 5 seconds. And the other ones were about 2 to 3 seconds.
Oh.
It was like one to the bang, and then a gap, and then bang, 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 bang.
Oh.
That was four stoves in the mixing house. That was five explosions. And when we looked outside the doors facing the long walk here, we saw the debris flying through the air. We saw all the timber.
Across Queensbridge, you could see.
We looked up Long Walk past the main lab.
Yeah.
You could see all the stuff falling, and that was falling for a good minute. It took a minute.
It got up so
high. Yeah, there was all sheeting, all coming down like this, and it took a good minute for that to settle. Yeah. And then the dust reached us. The dust from the explosion came out as well as the dust in that particular shop. You couldn't hardly see across the other side of the room. It was all choking. At that stage, we did run out the other door next to number 4 boiler house. Big chimney was towering right above us. I visualised for a split second that being broken in half and crashing on top of the machine shop, but it didn't. And so that was a rather frightening experience.
Yeah.
I was 18 at the time. I was 20, no, I happened in 1940. I was on Cordite Dyes at that time. I was on Cordite Dyes.
I suppose in the acid factory, it was quite, acid burns and that were quite the run of the
thing.
I know they used to have bars, didn't they? Old domestic bars.
No, that's right. They had domestic bars scattered.
Yes.
Here and there in the acid factories. South side as well, they had the bars scattered in their small acid factory.
Yeah.
They made more sulfuric south side. There is a story about Southside. It was at the end of the war period, whereas the cast iron vats were wearing very thin. When they were new, they were about 3 inches thick. Cast iron vats, about 8 foot diameter, and about 4 feet depth. Enormous things, really, built in brickwork and stoked at the front fires with coke. Behind them, where they were stoking, there was a wall. Unknown to everybody, of course, one of these vats had worn paper thin until it burst one morning. I think the person's name that was killed was Palmer. The hot acid just poured itself onto the hot coke fire and come out the fire hole. And he managed to run for it, I think, but it engulfed his legs and that, and he died. He was killed. And the in front of these vats, the acid finished up about 6 inches deep. And of course, after that, of course, the whole lot was condemned. And they found the other three were very thin. And so there was one man killed with acid burning through the iron, and then not really knowing. Just how long they would last. They knew they would last a good while, years I suppose, being 3 inches thick in the first place, but they didn't know at one spot, there was only one spot where the acid had gnawed through, and that broke through, and that rushed into the furnace, and that man was killed.
Because it would come, it would be heated in the furnace before it hit him, wouldn't it?
Hit the furnace before it hit him. It was more or less like an explosion. Yeah. It was lucky there was only one man killed there. And that was about 100 yards just inside the south side Quinton Gate, where the acid factory was. That's where that occurred.
The concentrators, were they the sulfuric concentrators? Because they did have...
Yes, there might have been. There was a lot of...
Yeah, oh, well,
anyway, a lot of plant just on the... Beg your pardon, on the right-hand side, as you went in Quinton Gate, a lot of that was renewed in ERDE's time from 1947 onwards. A lot of that plant was reconditioned and added to. A lot of extra plant was put there as regards pumps and vats and autoclaves. And then, of course, came the giant calcium cyanamide plant.
Was that on the south side?
That was classed as number two project.
Oh, yeah.
There was three stages of that. The first stage was under jurisdiction of Dr. Pride, Dr. Pride and Mr. Wallace. I'm not sure about the second one. The chemist finished up as chief supervisor at the Shelmex House in London. He was schoolmaster. He was project two. There was three stages. It was the calcium iron cyanamide plant was to manufacture picrolite with artificial ingredients, ammonia. They used ammonia to impregnate limestone.
Yes.
And that was the basis of this plant. The actual guana became very expensive from the island of Guana of South America.
Oh, yes.
They decided to make this.
But that's guana. That's made from bird lime.
Bird residue. Yeah. Became so expensive, they decided to make it artificial. The Americans said that it could be done, but it wasn't worth it, because they realised at the time the need for this picrolite was never going to be wanted on the scale again. Yeah. It was to mix with cordite and gun cotton to stop the flash Flashless explosive, it was known as, to stop the flash out of the barrels of naval guns.
Yeah.
Americans saw the folly of this, and as far as I'm jargon that was talked about at the time, it was an unnecessary thing to ever attempt.
Oh, yeah.
But being that they wanted to keep the factory open, so in my opinion, that's they went ahead with it.
Yeah.
It proved to be successful, as the Americans said it would be. But we had to go ahead to prove that we could do it ourselves.
Yes.
And when it was done, the need for it had gone. But certain small amounts of picolite, of course, are still used in small arms
ammunition. It was a white cordite it made, wasn't it?
When it finished up white.
Yes.
Because when it was through the manufacturing of this picolite, it was black.
Yeah.
And very dangerous to some people.
Oh.
Very dangerous. And called dermatitis and skin trouble to some people.
Yeah.
Others could wallow in it and not get nothing wrong with them. Others could only get near the building and it would affect them. That's how bad it was.
Yeah.
This, of course, was made in Northside before the war. Picolite, this flashless explosive ingredient, which you mix with cordite, was made up in Northside Acid Factory before the war and during the war. So when the gunpowder factory closed, of course, that was the end of that. But ERDE was asked to make this synthetic ammonia-based, or ammonia limestone material, which imitated this bird lime in order to make this flashless explosion. And that was known as the calcium cyanamide plant. Dr. Ayers, or Mr. Ayers, I believe he's still around.
Yes, I mean, I saw him the other week. Yeah.
He was on number four plant.
Oh, yes.
He knows more about the technicalities of all that than I do.
Oh.
I did invent a system to stop ammonia leaks from the giant stainless steel heaters.
Mm-hmm.
By using the new introduced TIG welding. TIG arc welding.
Yeah.
To weld strips of metal, and it could only be done with TIG.
Yeah.
In order to, the end cases of these heaters just simply had to be welded together.
Oh, yeah.
Because no-how would the casing stay intact because of the intense heat that was applied to them.
Mm-hmm.
Lou Page, the welder, done the welding.
Yes.
I myself I'd never put it through as a suggestion. I got nothing for it at all.
It's an inert gas jacket, I suppose.
It was ammonia gas that was leaking.
Oh, yes.
From the...
Oh, no, the actual TIG welding.
Yeah,
it
was.
IG stands for inert gas.
Yes, was to weld the end plates together with very thin sheet metal.
Oh,
so as the sheet metal could be ripped off with a chisel for cleaning and for repairing and for replacing the burnt out tubes.
Oh, yeah.
I never applied for anything. I never made no fuss about this at all. I regret now that I didn't.
Yes.
Because awards were being handed out left, right and centre for the most frivolous, stupid things that anyone could wish to see.
What was your idea?
My idea was to prevent ammonia gas leak in the number three plant under Mr. Hales that was down the main road, just before you meet the central stores.
What was the essence of your idea to prevent...
Essence was to prevent ammonia gas leaking
into the
brickwork, into the furnace.
By skin?
Because when the heat was applied to the heaters, the stainless steel plates started to bend, taking everything with it. The heat was so intense that the flanges would known in our, as curling up. They would start to move. The studs, the nuts, would do nothing to stop that. And the only way to stop that was, it was discussed with the foreman, of course, before my suggestion, was to weld them up solid. But then the problem come, how do you separate arc welding when you want to clean? You cannot.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'd have to re-machine the whole lot.
Yeah.
I suggested this strip stainless steel method, which proved to be 100% successful.
What, that is very thin.
That was to weld the two flanges together with a strip of stainless steel on the outside.
Yeah.
Before this happened, on the first two runs of this plant, nobody could enter the building because of the leak of ammonia gas.
Oh, yeah.
The risk was terrific there of getting blinded.
Oh.
And the plant was shut down about three times before a successful run was done. Yeah. And I claim that was thanks to me preventing this leaking from the heating tubes to heat the ammonia gas to impregnate the limestone.
Yeah, because it needed hot ammonia to impregnate the limestone.
Impregnated the limestone, which was allowed to cool down, and then that was crushed.
You never really got acknowledged.
I didn't get acknowledged at all for that.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's see, how are we going? Let's just check me. So when you first started, you were at the small arms factory.
Yeah, I was at the small arms factory first.
Yeah.
As most apprentices were recruited, especially from the engineering departments, under this supreme superintendent that was in charge of engineering, in charge of steam and maintenance at both factories.
I see.
So when I was transferred as a boy to the gunpowder factory, this gentleman said to me, "You'll like it down at my other factory. I'm in charge down there as well as here. And I will be seeing you." And I did. I used to run. He used to come out.
Oh, so that's when you started. Then you came over to the.
That was when I went down to the Powder Mill in 1936.
Oh, yeah.
I was down in Port Arms in 1935 when I was 15.
Were there any amusing incidents or that you can recall, Bob, you know?
Well, this is rather modern times. This is in ERDE times when the number 6 boiler house was discontinued. And the big flues were all broken away from the base. And the smoke shaft still stood there, quite a big one. Not too tall, not like the others, but massive. I always fancied I could see smoke coming out of that chimney for no reason. Well, when Bill Wilson, so I discovered something. So when Bill Wilson, the foreman, used to say to me, "Where's the heavy gang? I can't find them." I used to say, "Well, Bill, look up the top of that chimney." And Bill used to look at the top of that chimney, used to say, "But there's fine smoke coming out of there." And I used to say to Bill, "Well, now you know where your heavy gang are."
No price for guessing what was going on in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I told this story to a lot of other men, they wouldn't believe that. Yeah. Am I letting the cat out of the bag? Cigarette smoke would eventually reach the top.
Well, it was safe enough, wasn't it? They couldn't say it was a hazard.
It wasn't a hazard. No. That was the safest place in the factory for smoking. This was just prior to being allowed to smoke in the canteen.
I see. Oh, yes.
Just after the war.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
And that was always a little joke. So Bill used to say to me, "Where are they?" I said, "Well, have a look up at the chimney, Bill, and see where they are. If you saw any smoke coming out."
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, that's been, I think we'll have to end on that rather humorous note, Bob.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your memories, which are extremely informative and complete with this plan of the
I can add to that, because I've got a list of names here of men that came a year after this. You've got to remember that they are the real old timers.
Oh, yeah.
Especially that lot there.
Oh, well, we'll close the tape now. And before I go, we'll jot down the rest of these names on this sheet.
Yeah, these are the names of the new men that started possibly a year after 1936, 37, 38.
Okay, then, well, we're closed now, and we'll get this down on a bit of paper and make sure it goes into the records. Thanks very much, Bob.
Yeah, thank you.